In the gloom, he spotted a stairway hacked into the rock that led up into a tunnel. He climbed the first four steps with his hand trailing along one wall for support, when his fingers met with something that felt like an electrical switch. He touched it lightly, and the entire cavern was illuminated by bright fluorescent lights set into the rock walls. Pitt walked over to where Kelly and Giordino were searching through one of the boats. "I know another reason why your father kept this place a secret," he said slowly. Giordino stared at him. He'd known Pitt too long not to recognize when he was about to spring a revelation. Then he saw the direction in which Pitt's eyes were aimed. A long cylindrical iron vessel was moored to a dock along the far side of the cavern. The hull was covered with a thin coating of rust. The only noticeable protrusion was a small hatch tower set several feet aft of the forward bow. The vessel had not been visible in the darkened cavern interior until Pitt had turned on the lights.
"What in God's name is that?" Kelly muttered.
"That," said Pitt with a note of triumph, "is the Nautilus." At the foot of the dock, rising along the rim of the rock ledge, was a pile of stones stacked in the shape of a sarcophagus. A wooden plaque with carved letters revealed it as the final resting place of the submarine's creator. "Here lie the mortal remains of Captain Cameron Amherst, made famous by the writings of Jules Verne as the immortal Captain Nemo. May those who someday discover his tomb honor him with the respect he deserves." "My esteem of your father continues to grow," Pitt said to Kelly. "Knowing Dad built this monument with his own hands makes me proud." Giordino, who'd lagged behind after exploring a side cave, approached the dock. "I found another mystery that's been bothering me." Pitt looked at him. "Which mystery?" "If Dr. Egan had a hidden laboratory, where was the source of his electrical energy? I found it in a side cave. There are three portable generating units in there connected to enough batteries to power a small town." He pointed down at the dock and the series of electrical cables running along the edge and through the hatch of the submarine. 10 to 1, he used the interior for his laboratory.
"Now that I see the Nautilus close up," said Kelly, "it's much bigger than I imagined."
Pitt nodded in agreement. "I estimate her length at about 250 feet, with a 25-foot beam, larger than Verne described. She's close to the dimensions of the first Navy submarine with advanced hydrodynamic design that was launched in 1953. Giordino walked over to an electrical panel mounted beside a gangplank leading to the submarine's deck, next to the hatch tower. He pressed a pair of switches. The interior of the vessel was instantly bathed in light. Pitt turned to Kelly and motioned down the open hatch tower. "Ladies first." The entry compartment was small. In front of them was a door that looked like it belonged in a house rather than in a submarine. Pitt turned the latch, opened it, and stepped over the threshold. Silently, they walked through an ornately furnished dining hall 15 feet in length, centered on a teakwood table with beautifully carved standing dolphins for legs. At the far end was another door that led into a library, whose shelves Pitt guessed contained more than 5,000 books. The next compartment was quite large, stretching more than 30 feet. This area, Pitt was certain, was the grand salon that Verne had described as filled with art treasures and ancient artifacts Cameron had gleaned from under the sea. But the salon was no longer a museum and gallery. Elmore Egan had transformed it into a workshop and a chemistry laboratory. The room was filled with counters holding a maze of chemical lab apparatus, a spacious workshop with compact machinery, including a lathe and a drill press, and three different computer stations with an array of printers and scanners.
"So this is where one great man lived and another great man created," Giordino commented philosophically.
"Let's keep going," said Pitt. "I want to see where he built his teleportation sending chamber." They walked through another watertight bulkhead
into a compartment that had once held the air tanks. These had been removed by Egan to make room for his teleportation equipment. There were two panels with dials and switches, a computer desk, and an enclosed chamber that contained the sending station. Pitt smiled when he saw the 55-gallon drum marked Super Slick. It was connected to a timing device in a series of tubes, which were themselves connected to a round receptacle on the floor. Now we know where the oil comes from that keeps filling up Egan's leather case. He saw that the timing sequence was set at 14 hours. He reset it to 10. "What are you doing?" asked Giordino curiously. "I'm sending a message to Hiram Yeager and Max." They went through the next opening into the crew's quarters. What they saw here was the most mind-boggling of all. Here is where Elmore had stored the treasures that had once adorned the main salon and library. The canvases would have filled two rooms of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Leonardo da Vinci, Titian, Raphael, Rembrandt, Vermeer, Rubens, and 30 others were stacked in rows. Sculptures from antiquity, bronze and marble, stood in closets and individual crews' cabins. And then there were the treasures that Amherst had salvaged from ancient shipwrecks. Piles of gold and silver bars, boxes filled to overflowing with coins and gemstones. The value of the collection was beyond their comprehension. They spent nearly an hour combing through the great hoard before carrying on with their tour. After walking through another watertight bulkhead, they found themselves in the Nautilus's expansive engine room.